comments committee on Section 166 to order. We have a amendment to the House file, the House language of the Senate file, on the side by side, and do we want to have council walk through that, or do you want to?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to move the amendment, and I can go through it, I think, but I might need help.
Okay.
Mr. Fender, Mr. Stain may have to help me here.
Can I just ask a question?
We are, yes.
When I read through this before, why is there no reference to R5?
Because it's.
Does that mean it's a Senate amendment?
There's no reference to R5.
That just mean you just keep the Senate amendment? I don't get it.
Mr. Pender, I think, drafted this, so he can probably explain it back.
Madam Chair, what this amendment does is take the House language and then amend it. And so that's what this amendment does. So it doesn't, there's nothing on R5 because no changes are being proposed to R5 on House language.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, if I might, most of the bill is identical. There are some changes, and we decided to work from one set of language, and so we chose to work on the House language, and this amendment is to it. So if you are looking at the side by side, because at least you'd see that what it is we're taking from the Senate language, and so I can go through that. So when the House had in, R6, section beginning of section 5 in the House language, it mentions prospective purchaser on line 32, and I felt that there needed to be a definition of who was a prospective purchaser. So that is what the language on my amendment from 1.5 to 1.10 does. And I think it's pretty straightforward. Just defines, it's just a definitional term. Then line 13 of the amendment then takes you to page 2 of the House language, line 27, and we just strike a premium finance loan in which and say loan proceeds that. We didn't need that language. Line 1.16 deals with an issue we referenced a couple of times. Was it yesterday only? No, it must have been Wednesday, I'm sorry. And that's on lines 4.4 and 4.5 of the House bill, and we change, 4.4, and we change or to and. And then following over line 4.7, we strike economic. Okay. And that, I think, conforms to what we think is important to do for some concerns that were raised in the House and undoubtedly have spread to the Senate. And we'll just take that issue away. Then line 1.20 of the amendment has to do with line 34. So page 6, line 34, it's in the prohibition language. So, at the end of line 6.34, no prospective purchaser, et cetera, et cetera, may enter into a settlement contract or any other agreement the effect of which is to acquire the policy or beneficial interest in the policy. That's how that would then read. And page 712, okay. We're just eliminating the word policy, I believe, yes. Because it's a prospective purchaser, we don't need the word policy in there. Then, get down to 125 of the amendment, all the way over to 2.12, actually 2.14. Is the substance of the Senate language on the rebuttable presumption. The two lines, 13 and 14, I don't think are really necessary, they're kind of fluffy, but it does make it clear the rebuttable presumption is, does not apply in any criminal proceeding, which I think we all know doesn't, but we're just saying. We really mean it. Then, we have to do something to get rid of an and, and insert an and, line 12 and 19 on page 9 of the House language. And then after line 19, under, is it prohibited, this is list of fraudulent acts, excuse me, we add that from 219 to 222. And then at the bottom of the side-by-side, at the bottom of page R9, but it's page 10 of the House language, after line 5, which is at the bottom of R9, we would add a parens E. And this relates to Senate language on statute of limitations, which appears over on R10 of the side-by-side. And, you know, the Senate had the statute of limitations, they had considered the discussion about do we mean from the time the inception of the policy, or do we mean, you know, when is this? Well, we obviously meant after the death of the insured, and we changed it to 2 years, but we think that we should have that. So there's some definition to that. So we changed the 3 from the Senate language to 2. And then on the House language on the amendment, lines 227 to 230, we add the Senate language regarding the declaratory judgment action. And at the very end, we make the effective date the day following final enactment. Now, Madam Chair, you might, you know, if you want to discuss, we don't have, nobody in this room, probably I have the most time of anybody.
Just take a question.
Senator Reps.
Well, I'm looking at R3, line 4.4, that was amended by on line 116 of the amendment, where you deleted 4 and inserted and. What was the reason for that?
Senator Ress, that we had some lengthy discussion about that on the House floor, and there's some concerns about the interest engendered by love and affection and who would be included under that. And to make it clearer, we link those, which is the way the bill was introduced. When you look at paragraph B, when you take out economic interest, this would allow for care providers. Yeah.
So it was because of some controversy on the floor that you now want to have related by blood and by law.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to understand the difference then in the amendment on 2.3 of the amendment where it's okay there to have insured by blood or law. What am I not understanding in the difference there? That's what I want to know. Why is it or there rather than and?
Mr. Pender,
did
you
want to? Madam Chair and Senator Rest, there's an error in this amendment. The careless person that did this made a mistake. And on line 1.16, it should read, delete the second or. Because there are two ors in that line.
Oh.
On line 1.16?
You mean I actually discovered something?
Yes, you did.
Because I actually read this before, and it didn't make sense that if you didn't do it one place, it wouldn't make sense.
Well, thank you, Senator Retz, for pointing that out.
This is Senator, if I might.
Mr. Representative Acton.
On that same point, I actually caught it too, and I'm kind of proud of myself. But the question, and I'm not trying to be flippant, but you now have, so it's got to be by blood or by law, and in whom the individual has a substantial interest engendered by love and affection. Again, I'll say this, that I'm not trying to be flippant, but what happens if I don't necessarily have love or affection for my
spouse or children?
Well, or my brother-in-law. Yeah. And there's, you know, I actually like him sometimes better than my own brother, but by law, I have an interest in him. But I have an affinity for him, but not at all kinds.
Representative Atkins, this is basically, is it 31 states that have codified their insurable interest law like this? This is kind of standard. And then if you look at paragraph B, by striking the word interest, I would hope you had a greater interest in your brother-in-law. Striking economic. It allows for those, well, I guess you'd have the greater the greater interest in your brother-in-law living rather than dying, but it would be included under that paragraph. And then, you know, when you look further down, there's you're not allowed to get life insurance unless both parties agree and sign off on it. So there was some concern on the House floor, and we want to make sure that this bill get signed, and our understanding is this solution would make that that problem go away.
And I'm sure I get that part. I'm just I want to make sure that, you know, when we try to address one problem, we don't open up the door to another.
Yeah.
So with this, I have an elderly aunt who lives with a friend.
Mm-hmm.
They're not gay.
Yep.
They're just really good friends, and have been for a long time.
Yep.
They have signed off on each other's, think they're beneficiaries on each other's insurance and that kind of stuff. They'd still be okay.
They would be okay under paragraph B when we take out the economic interest. They're good friends and live together, and they have an interest in each other living over one of them dying for insurance benefits reasons. So they should be covered under paragraph. Paragraph B is clearly the kind of the more expansive definition of insurable interest at this point. So it would cover that situation.
Okay, whether or not they have an economic interest or not.
Since we struck the economic.
They may or may not.
Yeah.
Well, that was actually the reason that they did it, is because they were in a number of financial agreements together.
Yeah.
So this would say that they don't need to have economic interest in each other's ongoing preservation, but so long as they have some sort of lawful and substantial interest, whatever that may be. Okay. Should I just stop and not ask what that is?
Yes.
Well, and it's a substantial interest in the continued life of the individual insured, as distinguished from only an interest that would arise by the insured's death. So it's kind of the compromise we came up with on that particular issue.
I think it's fine. You may or may not have the economic interest. It's not required.
Yeah. Okay.
Are you waiting for a motion, Representative?
I moved.
Did you move the
item
with the correction?
As corrected.
Okay. We'll change your motion to the as corrected by
deleting the second.
Yes. Are there any other questions?
I was trying to go as fast as you were, Senator Shag, but I couldn't keep up on the lines. This would be on R7. Line 7.22 or 7.26 of the House language. And this was kind of an important issue that came up during the committee process, and we wanted to make sure that, I just want to make sure this language isn't deleted on the House side. It was so that people could share their information with their accountant or with their lawyer or their financial advisor. And I was trying to read it so fast, and I still haven't been able to catch up. Is that still in there?
Mm-hmm. And Chair, yes. Yeah. Yep. I would, that is still in there. I may have something to say. I think it stays.
It's there.
I can offer another amendment, but I don't intend to take that out. So.
I think we've been having kind of ongoing discussions with the Senate about some of their concerns about this, and I know, you had some proposed language to kind of tighten that up a little bit.
Madam Chair, I do, and it's separate from this larger amendment. I mean, we've had some pretty good.
Can we vote on this?
That's fine.
Madam Chair, can we vote on this and then we can move on?
Yes.
In case we have to.
Well, thank you. So, Senator Shad has moved that the A20 amendment be adopted as amended, as changed, as corrected. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
I did have one more question.
Too late.
Well, it's now part of the bill, so I suppose I could ask the question.
Yeah. Representative Atkins.
The testimony the other night on the premium financing and no recourse financing. I just want to make sure that I understood it. Is that the as far as insurers now, they don't do that. And I believe it was that if a potential
non-recourse,
that there is no non-recourse because I had to run my kids' conferences. My wife is out of town, so I was trying to do a lot of things at the same time. But I came in with the understanding that that could occur. And then there.
The insurer said they don't do it. They're doing it.
Okay, there is no non-recourse financing for the insurers because that was at the heart of this. And I talked to somebody that does this, and they said actually in the insurance industry it does happen. So, and I'm looking at Ms. Rowan. Is that
Representative Atkins? I think when we had testimony on Wednesday night, you had stated that the insurance agent companies wouldn't approve non-recourse financing if they could tell. And that's the point of the STOLE is you're oftentimes hiding some things in the fraud. And my sense is if you could tell it was non-recourse financing, it would not be approved, but it might be difficult to figure that out at the time of the issuance of the policy.
Okay, we might be talking two different things. The question I had was, can you, when you originally go to your insurance company, can you and the insurance company work out a deal for non-recourse loan financing?
Madam Chair?
Senator,
it's my understanding, no.
And that's what I thought, too, and that's why I heard differently since then, and was wondering if, what's good for one should be good for all, is kind of my thinking. And I actually, since at ING, I'll just use one example, and I asked Mr. Carlson to try to chase that down and get some evidence to show that, because I talked to somebody who said, actually, ING does non-recourse financing. I think that he was able to find something that showed that. And I just want to make sure that when we're talking about, maybe we're talking two different things, but if an insurer can do it, then shouldn't somebody that's not an insurer be able to, and I'm not trying to throw sand in the gears, I just want to make sure we're talking about the same. She's got a hand, but
I don't know. Ms. Rhoda, if you want to, I don't
She can just speak. It'll pick you up.
I can be really loud. I don't think I can. ING is actually on my board of directors, and I'm pretty sure they don't do non-recourse financing, but I haven't seen what Joel's got, so I can't comment on that. But the bill isn't, I mean, if an insurance company is doing some sort of non-recourse financing, then that would most likely be some sort of stolen policy, and that's prohibited whether we do it or someone else does it. So I don't understand. I guess I'm just kind of confused about the issue.
So this, and maybe so we can be clear, this would, if it passes as it is, this would prevent an insurance company from doing non-recourse financing as well. You're not, for the purposes
that's
of...
That's the way I understand it.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
To the purposes of STOLE, which is pretty much what non-recourse financing is used for.
Yeah, but that's what I thought too, yeah. But then I was, I saw at least the ING one where they sometimes apparently do it as part of a little bit more complex financial transaction, the initiation of the insurance. And I'm sorry for coming this late at it, but I hadn't made those assumptions until I heard that testimony on Wednesday. But if it prevents it for all, then whether the insurance company is doing it or not, this law in Minnesota, assuming it passes, would prohibit an insurance company from doing non-recourse financing as well. And everybody in the room is nodding.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
Is this issue? I want to get some information to the committee because I think there's disagreement about this premium issue, Madam Chair. Joel Carlson, for your table, I represent a company called Tomorrow Inc. And, Madam Chair, we have to be concerned about the language, continuing concerns about the language. I've testified about this in every committee. And that is the issue of premium financing that is approved by the carrier at the inception of the policy. And that premium financing is a tool that is used, we believe, on significantly high net worth individuals like the clients my firm deals with. And to even qualify, you have to have a net worth of in excess of $5 million. And what I have for the committee is, you know, some documents from ING about their premium financing program and how it works. It includes both recourse and non-recourse loans. That's the first document that I gave you. And I think there's some confusion. I don't think the insurance company itself provides the financing. They approve the financing. At its inception, there's a company, the next document down that I gave you is from a group called Premium Finance Group. They're a hybrid financier, and they list the requirements. This is a sheet they give to their agents on what the requirements are for Phoenix, ING, AXA, Transamerica, Principal, Hartford, and Allianz. And you'll see on the highlighted part as it relates to collateral, some just require the pledge of the policy, which would be excluded under the language of the bill. Many of them only require a 25% personal guarantee on the financing. And so it is not full recourse premium financing. And these are approved by the carrier before the inception of the policy. When you get to the the levels of how you qualify for these, you know, high net worth insurance policies, you have to have a net worth of in excess of $5 million, and you have to, before you even qualify, you have to be able to pay a policy premium that's in excess of $100,000 a year. Those people are all doing life expectancies because they want to know what the value of that investment is. It's our position in a completely legitimate transaction where they are working with their advisors, their accountants, their estate planners. They have a premium finance plan that is approved by the carrier at the inception of the policy. You are now creating a presumption that they have committed STOLE with the language in the bill. And we think that's unfair, particularly now where I have to hold that property for at least 4 years before I can do something with my asset, which at a minimum I would have paid at least $400,000 worth of premiums in. After the PFG hybrid financing, these are Lincoln Financial Groups. These are the lenders that they have approved for premium financing. from Lincoln Financial Group. These are all approved by Lincoln when they do their premium finance programs. They all agree to their terms. They have different requirements, whether they pledge the policy or they pledge parts of their personal collateral. The next sheet down from FICC Premium Finance Programs is from Minnesota Life and what their requirements are and some of the lenders and the tables that they use. The third fourth document down from chairing members is an actual application from Transamerica. The name of the individual client has been redacted. But you'll see in the highlighted area that you have to disclose on the application that premium financing is being done, who it's being done by, and the carrier has to approve that. And it's our position that any premium financing that the carrier approves at the inception of the policy, it is completely unfair to turn that into a presumed stolen practice. The last two documents, Madam Chair and members, are just additional information from ING that they give to high net worth seniors about how to maximize their estates by premium financing approaches, and some that include full recourse financing, some that are partial recourse financing. And we believe that the language of the bill, whether, and we don't believe it's necessarily intended, but we don't think the language of the bill fits with what actually goes on in the marketplace. And you are taking those seniors that use this as an investment strategy, which is promoted to them by the carriers, and turning that into a stolen practice. And so, you know, we ask as you consider this bill further, that you, at a minimum, you do not prohibit a premium finance plan that is promoted by a carrier as being a stolen practice, which I believe the language of the amendment and the bills do, and we've testified about that point in each of the committees that we've been in front of. And this is, you know, our chance to be heard on that, where you can see that they're actually doing and approving these premium finance loans that are pledged by the policy or by less than full recourse to the individual. And so, as you discuss this further, you know, we hope you'd at least consider that those packages that the carriers promote and that they know the financing package in advance do not trigger an implication of a stolen practice, which we believe on line 2.5 of the amendment, only if the insured is contractually obligated to repay the full amount of the loan and to pledge personal assets other than the policy or loan amounts exceeding the policy's cash value. Just the paper I gave you from Premium Finance Group shows that they, you know, many of these carriers only require 25% personal guarantee on the loan. And those are approved by the carrier in advance. And so we'd like you to at least consider exempting those from a stolen practice where they know up front. And we are talking premium financing or high net worth individuals. This isn't a senior who is unsophisticated. They know what they're doing. And this bill, we think, restricts their ability to change their investment the way the language is written. And we ask that you consider that as you move forward. We believe it's unfair, okay, the way it's written.
Senator Chad, Madam Chair, correct me if I'm wrong. I think we tie the non-recourse financing to the LE, the life expectancy evaluation.
You do, Madam Chair.
And I can only go by, you know, things people have written and said. Mr. Weinberg was mentioned the other day. He's a law professor and I think a trusts and estates and trust attorney, and also I think does a lot of consulting or whatever concerning life settlements and is considered an expert, I think, by people on all sides of this issue. And his statement, very recently, I don't have a date on this, but this is like timely.
the procurement of an LE, which is a life expectancy evaluation, prior to the purchase of life insurance is the single most obvious and common indicator of a STOLE transaction. And that the tie, I think, tie in here. I don't know if ING is doing a life expectancy evaluation. They may be doing some sort of a medical exam, like the one I talked about, where they come to your house and check your blood pressure, et cetera, or have you fill out a questionnaire about whether or not you've had cancer or been treated for heart disease. But I don't think that they, I have no idea whether they do a life expectancy, but guess what? I just think that we need to take a strong stand about what I think is an insidious practice of enticing people to purchase life insurance, frankly, without some suitability requirement. We don't have that in here. Yesterday or the day before, I guess when we were meeting, I think Senator Herb Cole was having a subcommittee on aging hearing in the United States Senate, and took a lot of testimony from people. This same gentleman commented, I hope I have it with me, I have so many papers, commented that the proposed Minnesota legislation is the most modern and well-considered insurable interest law I've yet seen. And I think that's important because he understands the industry very well. And the kind of thing that I'm trying to stop, let me just read an example. I won't name a company. This is from the Florida Deputy Commissioner testifying in Congress. One transaction involved an individual with two life insurance policies with a face value of $19.4 million. Received something a little less than $1 million in a life settlement agreement for that, okay? The brokers involved, allegedly, were paid over $1 million. The broker collected a $247,707 bonus from the investor for keeping the total cost under $2.5 million. $19 million worth of life insurance. It's outrageous. And I don't know that anybody talked to that person about their insurability. We've all seen the case that the Department of Commerce is conducting an investigation right now into someone who sold multiple big dollar life insurance policies to people. I think we just really have to stop this. And I think that everybody got something. This is from a website on your wealth, and it talks about a major opportunity in life insurance for seniors. It's called non-recourse premium financing. And it goes on to say, this opportunity is real, but it will probably not last very long. At least, and it's not talking about Minnesota's requirement, but Congress is looking at this. I mean, we are looking at this. If we enact this and the governor signs it, we will have the strongest anti-STOLE legislation in the country. And I think that's a positive thing.
Madam Chair,
did you say you had another amendment?
Madam Chair, I do.
We have heard lots and lots of testimony, and it seems to me that a number of things are getting repeated.
Yeah.
And
I'm sorry.
I don't need them repeated.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Atkins.
Before Mr. Carlson started talking, I had the floor, and I was just looking to see if he had that. But the reason I brought it up is because after I heard what the comments were on Wednesday about insurance companies don't do non-recourse financing when the policy's initiated. I had one of those goosebumpy type moments last night as I was ruminating on it, thinking about it. I called the fellow that sold me life insurance several years ago, and who was a friend. He lives about three blocks from me. He sells policies to a bunch of lawyers. He's actually one of these companies he sells for. And the policy that I bought from him, one of the options I had was to do a variety of types of financing. He sells to a lot of lawyers, I might add. The other one was, in addition to that, I realized that they had probably done a life expectancy on me, because I went through and answered all the various questions and so forth. And I, the reason I got the goosebumps is I thought, holy crap, I think I might have bought a strolling policy. They were, somebody was hoping for me to die. But it was, you know, the beneficiary was my wife and all of that. So I think that that protected me from anybody, unless she gets mad at me, unless it's not me. But when I just want to make sure that we don't stop those legitimate sales from occurring, where I can buy, you know, one of the options he had was the financing proposal. So I put down this much is a loan, and there are a variety of options that we talked about, all of which it's my understanding that are perfectly legitimate. And so long as we don't stop those, I absolutely, Madam Chair, I'm 100%, 150% behind stopping the idea of STOLE, and it's completely anathema to public policy that we should be hoping for someone else to die. But I just want to make sure that we don't, in the language, we stop the original transaction taking place. So if we have that assurance, I think we're...
Madam Chair? Senator Shine?
Madam Chair and Representative Atkins, I suspect that the results of your life expectancy evaluation, if there were one, was not shared or were not shared with someone for the purpose of determining the actual or potential value in the secondary market. So,
yeah,
I mean, we
no,
did that language.
There were no offers forthcoming for people
who wanted
to. It's when one of your colleagues has a policy on you, Representative Atkins, you have to worry about that. I do have another amendment if we're done there.
Senator Scheid, in looking at this, is, and Mr. Carlson, and I don't know if you had this information earlier or if it just appeared recently, but I mean, it looks, there's guarantees, there's personal guarantees, and you know, stating the lender may call the loan and require immediate repayment if there's default, and there's if premium financing doesn't mean a free pass of non-recourse financing. And so I'm not quite sure where you're pointing out in this, but I think...
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, my point is that...
Mr. Cobb.
Is that a number of carriers approve premium financing that either just require the policy to repay the loan, or they require the insured to pledge less than full recourse for the loan. And they are approved by the carrier up front. And I think that's unfair to the consumer to have them approve the financing plan, which they do, and that's required on the application, and then say that that is a STOLE practice.
So Mr. Carlson, what you're basically saying is there is some recourse of either the policy or percentage of the loan in these, or a combination of the two. There is recourse.
Yes, but
Mr. Carlson,
to repay the full amount on page 2.6.
Madam Chair.
Senator Moore.
So what if it's a presumption on them?
Yeah.
Come to the table and defend that you're not a stole. Period. Can we move on?
I'm happy to move on, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Atkins, are your questions answered, or do we need a Mr. Carlson has repeated his position several times, but if we need the life insurance representatives to clarify that. I mean, I know several committee members don't want that, but I, Representative Atkins, just so you're comfortable, I would.
I certainly don't want to be thrown out of this lovely Senate.
We have 10 minutes.
Actually, I really do want to get thrown out of here. Actually, it's fairly warm and small in here.
the
chief reason for bringing it up was actually on behalf of the insurers in the room, not the life settlement folks. I actually talked to Mr. Carlson because I think he knows the same fella that is selling wires insurance, and that's, I assume, who we got some of this stuff from. But the point of that is so that the insurers can still be able to sell the product that they're, I believe, currently selling. And in some instances, for a lot of people, makes a great deal of financial planning sense.
Senator Moore.
Well, Madam Chair, is there enough people with this kind of asset out there? I'm sure there would be plenty of these sales taking place. And the people who are presumed to have to kind of defend these kind of practices, I'm sure they have plenty of resources to make this work for them. It is the vulnerable people that we're here to do something about. And so
I'd like to offer the 821, and this is in response.
Senator Scheid, does everyone have the 821? Or they're handing it around right now.
And Madam Chair, this would go to some of the testimony we had yesterday about the investors and their ability to have some certainty as to whether or not they were making a sound investment or that there some stole may have gone on, at the inception of the policy. So this is asking, it's saying the prospective purchaser shall request, and then the broker, the settlement broker, shall provide certification in which a broker certifies that to the best of his or her knowledge, any life expectancy evaluation performed was not used or shared in determining the actual potential value of the policy in the secondary market. And then the bottom half of this language of the amendment, of the 821 amendment, adds a new parentheses under fraudulent acts. It adds a, and it has to do with, it relates back to the certification. And so I would like to offer that. I think that it's probably a prudent thing to do to have that broker certified. So.
And Madam Chair, I've got two next to me, but not one right in front of me, so I'm trying to look at Mr. Penders. And so my understanding is, and this was written, and we want to make sure that someone can share information with their broker and their financial advisors, attorneys, but making sure that it's not used beyond that. And if it is in a case, and if you are basically lying and said you haven't done that, that would be insurance fraud. Okay. And this is a concern arising from the House language of being able to share that information. And this is just tightening up that language.
Chair, correct.
Okay.
And I think that it gives the investors, I don't know if the word comfort is right, but at least they would have the broker certifying to them that this hadn't been done. So it sounded like there was concern in the investment community. The people who purchase these as investments, and
those purchasers wanted to have some assurances that
yes,
they weren't purchasing STOLE practices, STOLE policies. Are there any questions about this amendment? Seeing no question.
Representative Atkins. Let's assume in the non-STOLE world, and I'm trying to read this in context of the language that we have. If I go to my financial advisor and I have just a legitimate life insurance policy that I've had for 3 years or 30 years or however long, they would still be able to price that to sell it in the whatever market there happens to be. Is that right?
Representative Atkins, they would be able to price it if it wasn't priced before it was sold within that 4-year period of time. They could have discussed that with their financial planners, but not outside investment groups, whoever. And if it and it's to be clear, it's a life expectancy previous to the policy up to the date of the policy being issued. So if it was to happen afterwards or to sell it 3 or 30 years later, to sell it in that market, then that wouldn't be a problem.
And then my only other question, Madam Chair, to the author would be, if I go to my financial advisor, and insurance is just going to be part of my package of the estate planning, and we have a life expectancy done, did they that as they go out to, you know, we price out a $2 million policy or a $1 million policy. And I apologize for kind of flailing away here. I just trying to make sure that I have my head around what this allows.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shine.
Madam Chair, it doesn't preclude anything. It just says that the broker will have to certify to the prospective purchaser. The prospective purchaser isn't the insured, right? It's the investor. So, and it's just requiring a certification from the broker to them.
But it says that it's a certification that life expectancy done prior to the
anyone done on that
was not used by or shared with any other person prior to issuance of the policy for the purposes of determining the actual potential value of the policy.
Mm-hmm. Prior to the issuance is pretty key to that.
I think I understand.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Senator Scheid moves the A21 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. With that, I think we're done with adopting the language. And I think we've had pretty thorough discussion about this bill in over several committees and in this conference committee. So we are hoping this could be the last one. We can move it. I need some help in what that motion would be. Senator Scheid.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I would move that the Conference Committee adopt the House language as amended by the A20 and A21 amendments.
Thank you, Senator Scheid. Is any questions about that motion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The language is adopted.
And then, Madam Chair, we will circulate copies of the conference.
Circulate this for. Thank you, members, for your patience.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.